This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we turn yet again to the ongoing judicial misconduct in the case of environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger. Two judges in New York, aided by a powerful law firm that has represented the oil industry, continue their litany of unscrupulous attacks on this human rights attorney.
We'll also speak with Clifford D. Connor, professor of history in New York City and the author of the recently published book, The Tragedy of American Science, From Truman to Trump.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. 2 days after we recorded this interview with attorney Lauren Regan, Stephen Donziger's trial was postponed until November 3rd, Election Day. Holding a controversial case on a holiday or a federal day of significance is a common government tactic. It eclipses media coverage and public attention of historic cases to keep injustices from receiving widespread scrutiny. Last week, dozens of legal organizations representing more than 500,000 attorneys, along with more than 200 individual lawyers, submitted a judicial complaint against Senior U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, Judge Louis A. Kaplan. The violations were directed at human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger, whose case we've been following on Law and Disorder. Listeners will recall that Donziger won a historic judgment against the Chevron Corporation in Ecuador to clean up the pollution caused by decades of oil drilling there with no environmental controls. The complaint was filed by the National Lawyers Guild and the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. The Chief Judge of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, Robert Katzman, has a duty to read the complaint and determine if he will appoint a committee to investigate and issue findings. The complaint documents a pattern of ethics violations committed by Judge Kaplan, a former tobacco industry lawyer. Kaplan has denied Donziger a jury trial and put in place a series of unusual courtroom tactics that severely restrict the human rights attorney's ability to mount a defense. As well, Kaplan has detained Donziger at home for more than 1 year on contempt charges. Kaplan allowed Donziger to be prosecuted by a private law firm that has Chevron as a client, and he fined the human rights lawyer $3.4 million in contempt fees, setting a record in the United States. The complaint against Kaplan alleges that, quote, the statements and actions of Judge Kaplan over the last 10 years show him to have taken on the role of counsel for Chevron rather than that of a judge adjudicating a live controversy before him. Despite accepting jurisdiction in Ecuador, Chevron came back to the United States and filed a civil racketeering or RICO case against Donziger and all of the 47 named plaintiffs. They potentially sought $60 billion in damages, the highest personal liability in U.S. history. Judge Kaplan denied Donziger a jury and let Chevron pay a witness at least $2 million while moving him and his entire family from Ecuador to the U.S. Chevron lawyers coached the witness, Alberto Guerra, for 53 days before Kaplan let him testify against Donziger. But Guerra later admitted under oath that he had lied on the stand. Another violation was Kaplan's refusing to let Donziger testify on direct examination. 29 Nobel laureates and several human rights organizations have criticized the harassment of Donziger by judicial authorities and have demanded his immediate release. Joining us today is Lauren Regan, a member of Stephen Donziger's defense team. She is also executive director of the Oregon-based Civil Liberties Defense Center and a member of the National Lawyers Guild. Lauren Regan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Lauren, in 2011, attorney Stephen Donziger helped indigenous peoples in Ecuador win a $9.5 billion environmental judgment against Chevron Corporation. You have a background in environmental law. What was the significance of this case?
Yeah, when they first won this case on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorian people living in the Amazon, it was actually closer to $19 billion. And this was one of the landmark environmental justice cases that were brought on behalf of indigenous people against the fossil fuel industry for, you know, what we all know is rampant pollution, cancers, birth defects, not to mention just the destruction of the drinking water sources and the land itself. We know that there is a long legacy of fossil fuel industries going into places where they believe that the people have, you know, little power to fight them off or to try to hold them accountable. And so to have a legal team that was made up of both Ecuadorians and American environmental and human rights lawyers was really significant. And this judgment was really going to create excellent precedent for holding the fossil fuel corporations like Chevron and Exxon and, you know, and others accountable for the devastation that they've wrought around the world. And so it wasn't necessarily surprising that Chevron was going to do anything in its enormous powers to try to deter future lawsuits of this kind from being filed at other locations and even against other fossil fuel companies as well. But I don't think anyone ever imagined that Chevron would go to the lengths and to the extent that they have gone to in order to not only attack Stephen as one of the attorneys on the team, but I think almost more importantly, the extent that they've gone to in going after him in the legal system is really meant to be chilling to other lawyers and other potential litigants. You know, I think the graver threat right now with regard to this case is that they are basically saying to plaintiff's lawyers, to environmental lawyers, and to potential litigants, if you dare to hold us accountable in the legal system, this is what will happen to you individually if you do so. And, you know, and I think that's the primary reason why I felt it was so important to get involved in the case pro bono, is because, you know, as someone that's done environmental law and, you know, goes after the fossil fuel companies on behalf of activists, you know, I think I and many other environmental lawyers saw this as an incredibly dangerous case. But for minor differences, we could be in that target zone ourselves.
How did you come to be a member of the Donziger legal team?
They reached out to me based on the work that I've done on necessity defenses for environmental and climate defenders around the country. And I also am the chair of the legal working group of the Protect the Protest Coalition, which is a coalition of nonprofits and lawyers that specifically focus on defending activists and organizations against SLAPP suits, SLAPP standing for strategic lawsuits against public participation. And we view Stephen's situation, the multiple lawsuits brought by Chevron, and even the criminal contempt case that we're currently focusing on, this is basically a SLAPP suit on steroids. You know, this is sort of the worst case scenario when a massively powerful, rich corporation basically vows to destroy its adversary. And so we felt, you know, it was also just incredibly important to stand in solidarity with him, you know, from that vantage point as well.
This case is really the perfect storm if you were teaching an ethics course in law school. It has it all. How would you present Stephen's case to law students who may be more naive than long-term practitioners?
First of all, we need to remember the importance of the right to a jury trial and the right to have impartial fact finders within the legal system. And at the very beginning, when Chevron filed this racketeering case against Stephen, one of the first moves that Chevron and the court made was to remove the right of a jury trial. And then I think the second important thing is that there is incredible value in the appearance of impartiality and the importance of the judges not appearing to have bias toward one party or the other. And especially in the Trump regime, this is going to become more and more problematic, I think. But in this case, the original judge, Judge Kaplan, you know, he is a former tobacco industry defense lawyer. You know, he went up against plaintiffs, public interest lawyers his entire career and had quite a bit of animosity for them. And throughout the RICO proceedings, he made statements basically illustrating his bias toward Chevron, talking about how important Chevron was to the economy and other things like that, just really signaling that he had picked sides in this matter. And that consistently played out throughout the RICO case, including, you know, what I think is generally most interesting to most lawyers and law students. It's been funny to see the number of lawyers that just didn't even know that this was possible. But basically, Judge Kaplan at one point, Chevron demanded Stephen Donziger's computers, passwords, cell phones, and other attorney-client privileged documents. And, of course, Stephen refused to provide those to Chevron. You know, they're his adversary. The computers contain legal strategy. It contained very vulnerable people living in the Amazon who cooperated and participated in different ways with the litigation over the course of a decade, many of whom did not want their names revealed to Chevron for fear of all sorts of different kinds of retaliation. And so he refused. And then Judge Kaplan basically ordered Stephen to turn over all of these things. It was really, really clear throughout the entirety of the proceedings that he had incredible scorn and disdain for Stephen in a way that I don't think many lawyers have ever actually witnessed, but he ordered Stephen to turn the devices over. And the normal way that a lawyer challenges a discovery order that they feel is incorrect under the law is that the lawyer says, you know, Your Honor, hold me in civil contempt of court. I invite you to find me in civil contempt of this order so that I can appeal it to the Court of Appeals and get a second opinion, basically. And in the meantime, the lawyer does not have to hand over the materials, because to do so, you know, would be letting the genie out of the bottle. There's not a way to put it back in. You know, the damage is done. And so under all normal circumstances, Stephen did exactly what you would expect a lawyer to do. He invited the civil contempt. Judge Kaplan found him in civil contempt. And then he immediately appealed to the Second Circuit with, you know, of the civil contempt ruling. And then Judge Kaplan did something extremely rare and really unprecedented. He drafted criminal contempt charges while the civil contempt was still pending appeal. And he walked those charges over to the U.S. Attorney's Office and basically said, you know, I want you to prosecute Stephen Donziger for criminal contempt. And to the U.S. Attorney's credit, they refused to file the charges. And that should have been the end of it. But then Judge Kaplan did something even more outrageous. He then appointed a prosecutor. He appointed a private law firm called Seward & Kissel to act as the U.S. attorney. And not only did he appoint a private law firm, but then later on we uncovered that that private law firm has Chevron as a client, had Chevron as a client as recently as 2018. And we even had ethics experts file declarations saying that that law firm had an unequivocal conflict, and especially with regard to criminal prosecutions, that there should never be even just the appearance of bias, let alone bias. And here is a private white shoe law firm that profits and makes tons of legal fees, not only off of Chevron, but Chevron affiliates, entities that work closely in that industry and with Chevron. Now that firm steps into the shoes of the U.S. Attorney's Office and gets to prosecute him. And then Judge Kaplan appointed the judge. Rather than using the traditional random assignment for federal judges, he handpicks Judge Loretta Preska to preside over the criminal contempt. But he doesn't take himself off the case either. And so Judge Kaplan basically is standing behind Judge Preska, whispering in her ear, and basically assisting in her conducting the case. She's supposed to be this neutral second look, you know, this criminal contempt judge. But instead, her role, in my opinion, is basically to keep the machinations that Judge Kaplan created in play. You know, her job is to basically finish what Judge Kaplan began. And, you know, from the minute that that criminal case was filed, we knew that it was not business as usual. You know, for instance, you know, not only do we now have a private law firm representing Chevron getting to be the prosecutor of him again, and we have this handpicked judge presiding over the matter, but when Stephen shows up for his arraignment on this criminal contempt charge, he ends up having to post an $800,000 bond, and he is ordered into home detention. He has to wear an ankle bracelet, a GPS monitoring device, 24 hours a day. He had to surrender his passport, and they threatened his bar license right off the bat. And in fact, for over a year, Stephen has been in home detention with that ankle bracelet, unable to leave his apartment without permission for like court appearances or medical appointments, based on this minor criminal contempt charge. In fact, subsequently, Judge Preska was forced to acknowledge that the maximum punishment available on this charge is 6 months. And from our research around the country, the most severe sentence that has ever been handed down in a federal court against a lawyer for criminal contempt was 90 days of house arrest. Stephen has spent more than four times that already on home detention without even being convicted of any charges.
Lauren, I have to stop you here. You remind me of several things. One is the so-called Mumia exception in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, where the law simply doesn't apply to him in the Pennsylvania courts. This sounds like the Donziger exception. And in terms of the RICO charges, we know those are notoriously hard to defend against. We saw in New York City, for example, housing project gang arrests of teenagers who knew one another in tight communities. RICO was invoked, and it was hard for the kids to find competent defense attorneys. And then Donziger was fined $3.4 million in contempt fees? Finally, our listeners know of Judge Loretta Preska because she sentenced our hacker friend Jeremy Hammond to 10 years in prison, even though she had a conflict of interest in that case because her husband had been a client of Stratfor, one of the companies that was hacked, and she refused to recuse herself.
Yeah, it was $200,000 a day. And that is in addition to the $60 billion request for judgment that Chevron made against him. for that RICO case.
Lauren, I want to ask you about the media blackout in this case. Have you seen this in other political cases where, for example, the media is just not covering Stephen's story?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the media is afraid of Chevron. You know, when they see a corporation like this going after a lawyer, that is one of the most chilling targets that can be picked, because very often, whether it's activists or journalists, when corporations like Chevron start going after the lawyers who represent people in court, using the legal means that are available, you know, when they become targets, everyone else becomes very afraid. You know, I think there's like overwhelming experience, you know, historically, that when lawyers are targeted, everybody else begins to bite their fingernails, basically. So I also think the case was purposefully made so confusing and complex that a lot of journalists just don't have the time to try to figure out what is true and what is not. You know, there was such a railroading that occurred during that RICO trial that I think a lot of journalists just kind of throw up their hands and say, I'm not sure, you know, which direction to go with this, so I'm just not going to cover it at all. I think that's becoming increasingly less the case. You know, I think when 30 Nobel laureates and 500 international lawyers, you know, and so many people have kind of come forward. Now there's this trial monitoring team that's been put into place. You know, EU parliaments, and international tribunals have come out saying that they have grave concerns about this railroading that's occurring, and just the appearances of bias and conflict and injustice that manifest themselves in this case. I think, you know, little bit by little bit, media outlets are covering it. But, you know, as we talk today, it's a week till the trial date. And, you know, one would assume that a lawyer that wins $9.5 billion against Chevron, that is then prosecuted for not turning over his attorney-client privileged information to that corporation, should be having a more amplified coverage or conversation about that.
Let's talk about the next court date, which when this show airs will be that same week. That appeal is scheduled to be argued on September 15th, but now Judge Kaplan wants the contempt charges to be heard on September 9th. The problem is you and other attorneys on the team can't travel from out of town to be there. So who's going to be with Stephen in the courtroom?
As of right now, that is completely up in the air. You know, last Thursday, after the prosecutor, Rita Gleavin, the Chevron law firm, after they, last week they filed a motion for what's called a Curcio hearing, claiming that two of my co-counsel, Richard Friedman and Zoe Littlepage, claiming that they had conflicts because they represented Stephen on the underlying RICO charges, and their names were on an email with regard to that representation. And so the prosecutor made a motion for a Curcio hearing, claiming that they had a conflict. And we had this Curcio hearing where Judge Preska was basically telling Stephen that if he didn't waive his constitutional rights, that she was basically going to kick off two of the longstanding lawyers on his legal team. And the legal team had to advise him, and he got separate counsel that basically said, you can't be waiving, you know, constitutional rights under these circumstances. You must preserve your rights for appeal given everything that's going on. And so he didn't waive his rights, and Judge Preska ordered that Richard Friedman and Zoe Littlepage be removed from the case. And that basically left me, the newest legal team member, and someone who lives in Oregon. And, you know, I had come into the case specifically for one specific part of the defense, You know, I'm new to the case. There's over 200,000 pages of documents and like 160 different videos. And, you know, I mean, it's a huge volume of material. And there's no way that I could be prepared to represent him in a week. And so then Judge Preska did this incredibly desperate move where she makes an order telling the former counsel, somebody who had withdrawn from the case several months ago, that she was going to basically resurrect him as the attorney of record and force him to try the case in a week. Because, you know, I actually had a doctor file a declaration saying that the only reason that I should fly across the country is if my life depended on it. That given COVID and the health risks involved in flying and, you know, the global pandemic that we are under, that, you know, no one should be flying unless their life depends on it. And certainly I should not be flying to New York City from Oregon for a misdemeanor contempt bench trial. And so far she has not ordered me to appear in New York City, but we're a week away and I'm still holding my breath if that doesn't happen.
Lauren, you just mentioned something that we need to highlight for our listeners. This is a misdemeanor charge we're talking about.
Yeah. So she basically orders this prior lawyer to come back into the case and to be ready to try the case on September 9th. And just today, that lawyer had to hire his own lawyer and filed a motion to vacate Judge Preska's order, saying that there was no way that he could, that he withdrew for legal and ethical reasons, that there was no way that, A, he was going to come back into the case, you know, basically for irreconcilable differences, and B, that there was no way that he could be prepared to try the case in a week, having just been informed that he was being recruited back into the case. And so as we speak today, we are waiting to see, A, what Rita Glavin files in response to that motion, and B, what Judge Preska will do at this point. There doesn't seem to be any lawyers to stand in the courtroom with him, and Stephen does not want to represent himself pro se. He, you know, is entitled to representation. And so, it's just really unclear. And the more that these issues and problems arise, the more it just seems like Preska is in an absolute panic to send Stephen Donziger to jail. It's even the appearance that she is a neutral fact finder or a neutral judge has flown out the window, over the course of less than a year. You know, his arraignment was basically a year to the date, which for those of us that do federal criminal cases, that is not a long time for a criminal case to go all the way to trial, especially during a pandemic. Like all of my other federal criminal cases around the country, in Iowa, in California, Washington, and Oregon, they've all been postponed out to like March, you know, to January because of COVID. So the idea that she's going to force us all into a courtroom in New York City on September 9th in the midst of a global pandemic, and we've filed two motions to postpone the trial for all sorts of reasons that were denied by her. And the only reason that she gives is she calls this a long set trial date, which of course it's not. And there's not even a jury. And there are no other trials going on in the Southern District of New York except for serious in-custody felony cases without 60-day waivers in place. So there's just so many abnormalities going on that are blatant right now with regard to this case that they're just digging a hole, you know, deeper and deeper, absolutely demonstrating bias and impartiality in favor of Chevron and against attorney Stephen Danziger.
Lauren, in our remaining few minutes, let's talk about how Stephen is doing during this crisis and these desperate moves on the part of the two judges.
I mean, I think he is resilient, but extremely stressed. The threat of being sent to prison for 6 months while COVID rages. He has a 14-year-old son and a wife. There are a lot of factors, but I have been kind of blown away by how, in the face of all of these circumstances, he remains strong and committed to the cause and to the Ecuadorians. He continues to try to work with folks to enforce the judgment against Chevron. They have not paid a single dime, even though the facts of the pollution that they caused are uncontroverted. No one disputes that Chevron is responsible for the devastation that has taken place in the Ecuadorian Amazon. They have not even so much as built a single health center to help the indigenous people with the horrific illnesses that have resulted from that pollution. Instead, they have spent over $60 million, I think it is, in prosecuting Stephen. And that's just shameful. It shouldn't be surprising for the fossil fuel industry, but it's incredibly unfortunate. And I think, that old adage, stronger we are united, really kind of holds true. They picked off one attorney in this instance, and they've attempted to marginalize him and go after him. But I think if we stand in solidarity with people who are targeted in this way, it gives protection to all of us, because there's no doubt that the fossil fuel corporations are going to continue using this playbook. It's been really effective for them so far. Stephen's been in litigation now for years and years as a result of winning a lawsuit. And so, I think we really need to push back, and we really need to show strong solidarity as public interest lawyers so that, more of us are not targeted in the same way.
How can our listeners learn more or get involved in helping Stephen?
Well, our website is cldc.org, which stands for Civil Liberties Defense Center.org. And we've got a bunch of information and ways that you can plug in there. I believe there is a website called Make Chevron Clean Up, where you can find more information about the case and to support Stephen as well. And I know he's pretty prolific on Twitter as well, if your listeners are Twitter users.
Yes, we'll be sure to put a link to Stephen's Twitter on our website. Lauren Regan, you are a wonderful addition to Stephen's legal team. We would love to have you back on the show to talk about your other political defense work. And we will be waiting with bated breath to hear what happens in court next week. Thank you for your fine work on this and in so many other areas.
Thank you, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Science came out of the Enlightenment. Research then was unbiased and done in the interests of the public. This is no longer the case with the militarization of science and its corporatization. In our times, biased research has been conducted to show that tobacco doesn't cause cancer, that chemicals and pesticides used in agriculture do no harm, that opioids will not kill thousands, and that there's no such thing as human-caused climate change. Science and technology has been chained to the military. Science and technology has been chained to the military, where trillions of dollars have been spent in the effort to more effectively kill people. The U.S. economy's addiction to military spending distorts and deforms science by making it overwhelmingly subservient to military interests. This has transformed science from the classic idea of a creative force for the advancement of humankind into its destructive and anti-human opposite. that trillions of dollars in resources and scientific talent, not only devoted to solving the problems of poverty, disease, and environmental destruction, is one of the greatest tragedies of our times. We speak today with historian Clifford D. Connor. Dr. Connor teaches the history of science at the School of Professional Studies, the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City. He's the author of A People's History of Science and biographies of three revolutionaries, John Palmer Rhode, Arthur O'Connor, and Colonel Edward Marcus Despard. Professor Cliff Connor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks for inviting me to be on the show. I'm a longtime listener.
Well, and I wanted to tell our audience, we're longtime friends. You know, Cliff, I've known you for some 50 years. I remember when we first met on an anti-war demonstration during Vietnam in 1969 in Atlanta. And then just a couple of years ago, I co-edited a book with Debbie Smith and Francis Golden called Imagine, Living in the Socialist USA. And you were the scientific historian that contributed a chapter on what science would be like if we didn't have capitalism. And that turned into this book that you've written, The Tragedy of American Science. Cliff, it's really a really good book. I encourage people to get it. And I wanted to ask you, can you summarize the book's message for us?
Sure, sure. Actually, I can do it in two words and in two sentences. The two words are corporatization and militarization. The tragedy of American science is that it's been used primarily to serve the interests of corporate profits and war. And then the two sentences I actually use as an epigraph for the book. They're written by the literary critic Perry Eagleton. And I'll read those two sentences. The language of enlightenment has been hijacked in the name of corporate greed, the police state, a politically compromised science, and a permanent war economy. Scientific rationality and freedom of inquiry have been harnessed to the ends of commercial profit and weapons of war. So I think Terry Eagleton really hit the nail on the head. So I think most people think that science and technology should be used for the benefit of humanity, to make life better for the billions of people on the planet. But in the United States today, science and technology have been corrupted to drive ever-growing economic inequality and war. And that's just about the greatest tragedy I can imagine.
Why did you write the book now? What did you hope to accomplish?
Well, about 5 years ago, you asked me to contribute a chapter to the book you were just talking about, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And you asked me to describe how science and technology might be improved if the United States were to become a socialist country. But in the process of doing that and thinking about how much better things could be, that forced me to think about the current practice of science and technology in this country. And that led me to realize how tragic it really is. So I wound up expanding the essay to book length. And that's how this new book came to be.
At the end of World War II, expectations of what American science and technology could accomplish in peacetime were virtually unlimited. And disease would be conquered and hunger eradicated. New industries and inventions would create global prosperity. And the rockets that had carried German bombs would instead extend human exploration to the moon and beyond. Now, 75 years later, we look back and wonder, what happened to that dream? What happened, Cliff?
Well, that's exactly the historical question I set out to answer. Where did everything go wrong? I see the root of the problem in the Cold War, which is usually thought of as a conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. And it was that, of course, but it didn't begin like that. It began with the United States breaking its wartime alliance with the Soviet Union and treating its former ally as an absolute irreconcilable enemy. We all know that Stalin was a brutal dictator with no redeeming qualities. But the point I'm trying to make is that Stalin didn't want a Cold War with the United States. Stalin didn't want any kind of war with the United States. He wanted a permanent arrangement that would let the United States run the capitalist part of the world and leave Stalin on his own to run his part of the world. So the point I'm making is that the Soviet Union didn't start the Cold War. It was the American policymakers who insisted on demonizing the Soviet Union and instilling fear and paranoia in the American population. And that was the origin of many of our current problems, including the tragedy of contemporary American science. Cold War paranoia about the so-called Soviet threat is what was used for decades as the rationale for devoting an absolutely absurd proportion of our national resources, including our scientific resources, to creating ultra-high-tech weapons of war.
You said that the message of the book might be summed up in two words, corporatization and militarization. Let's talk about those two broad subject areas. Let's start with corporatization. What's the fundamental problem with corporatization of science?
Well, corporatization and privatization are two interchangeable words. You could either call it the corporatization of science or the privatization of science. Same thing. Anyway, about half of the book discusses the corruption of American science that comes from its domination by corporate interests. The classical ideal of science is that it's supposed to be unbiased investigation and not a way of proving something you want to prove. You've heard the phrase science in the public interest. The opposite of that is science in the private interest, which, as far as I'm concerned, is an oxymoron, a pure contradiction in terms. Any research done in the private interest doesn't deserve to be called science at all, as far as I'm concerned. And that includes all of the research done directly by corporations or funded by corporations, which is to say the vast majority of research done in the United States today. If anybody insists on calling that science, I insist on adding the adjective corrupt. It's corrupt science, corrupted in order to drive economic inequality. If most of the research in the United States is devoted to increasing corporate profits, which it is, that's what I mean when I said that science has been corrupted to drive economic inequality. I can give you some examples if you like.
Please do.
I think maybe the worst example was the decades of so-called tobacco science that aimed to prove that cigarettes don't cause cancer, smoking doesn't kill people, nicotine is not addictive, secondhand smoke isn't dangerous. And more recently, we've had the scandal of pain management science that was corrupted to favor the marketing of addictive opioids that have killed hundreds of thousands of people. And of course, there's the whole absurdity of the scientific pretensions of climate change denial, which I discuss in detail in the book.
Is it fair to say that all American science has been corrupted by corporatization? Hasn't, for example, the National Institute of Health produced some valid and valuable knowledge in the medical sciences?
Yeah, that's an FAQ, a frequently asked question. I get that a lot. And the answer is yes. I acknowledge that capable scientists at the NIH have performed valuable research in the medical field. That doesn't mean, however, that the NIH's practices have been beyond the reach of corporate corruption. Corporate influence is strong in the NIH, and I give some clear examples of that in the book. Its funding comes mainly from the federal government and so-called charitable foundations. But the federal support has been dwindling, especially under Trump. And if you look closely at the foundations, you'll find a lot of corporate influence there. And this isn't just an American thing, it's worldwide. You might think the World Health Organization is free of corporate influence, but it isn't. 30% of the WHO's total budget is from private donors or grants and from governments deeply influenced by Big Pharma. As for the philanthropy of the foundations, that actually has a name now, philanthrocapitalism. Have you heard that before?
No, it's funny.
Well, you can think about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They fund scientific projects all over the world. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it depends on what the projects are. I don't have a lot of faith in the Gateses.
Exactly. They undeniably help a lot of poor people in a lot of poor countries. But the problem is, why do scientific projects like that help people have to be funded by very wealthy private individuals like Bill and Melinda Gates? In any rational world, all that would be publicly funded. The Gates Foundation provides things that negligent governments of rich and poor countries alike fail to provide. This philanthrocapitalism problem like all charity, doesn't address root causes. The endemic health crisis of the third world, that comes from its poverty. The Gates Foundation's endowment, the last time I checked about 3 years ago, was at that time more than $50 billion. I'm sure it's much bigger now. But they don't keep that $50 billion in a vault in the form of cash. They invest it. And a huge proportion of its investment portfolio is in, guess what? Big Pharma.
Yeah.
So in the final analysis, the Gates Foundation is in partnership with Big Pharma in perpetuating and exacerbating global economic inequality.
But what about global warming and climate change denial? How big of a role do these issues play in the tragedy of American science?
Well, obviously they play a huge role. And as you know, that's been going on long before Trump came around. First of all, let's understand that it's not a scientific dispute where both sides are trying to get to the truth. The arguments of the fossil fuel lobbyists and the politicians on their payroll aren't made in good faith. They're simply mouthpieces for billionaire investors who own the fossil fuels industries. Those are trillion-dollar industries. The global oil market's worth about $1.7 trillion a year, and the coal industry's also valued at more than $1 trillion. Those investors are kind of like the slaveholders before the end of slavery. They don't want to lose their investments. They don't want to lose trillions of dollars of their wealth. So they put up fierce resistance, and we have to wage an equally fierce uphill political battle against them. The investor class has almost all of the financial resources on their side, but we have much more on our side in the way of human resources. As the poet said, we are many, they are few.
One of my favorite poems. We're speaking with Professor Cliff Connor. He's just written The Tragedy of American Science, From Truman to Trump. Cliff, let's talk about the other tragic aspect of American science, militarization. Explain the chapter title, Science Harnessed to the Chariot of Destruction, please.
Okay, I think now we're really getting down to brass tacks here. Let me quote a line directly from the book. Science and technology, rather than being the creative engines of human progress, have instead been reoriented toward destructive and anti-human ends. I have to say that, in my opinion, this is the most tragic aspect of American science. Most people, I think, expect or at least hope that our scientific institutions will devote their efforts to producing knowledge that will benefit the human race. But unfortunately, the trillions of dollars the American government spends in the name of science are primarily devoted to perfecting military technologies of death, finding new and better ways to kill people in large numbers, from thermonuclear bombs to robot drones, cluster munitions, anti-personnel weaponry of almost infinite variety. Former Defense Secretary James Mattis put it this way, when he was arguing for more money in front of Congress. He said, I need to make the military more lethal. Now, this may sound exaggerated, but when I say trillions of dollars are devoted to military research, that's based on official government accounting that greatly understates the real size of the expenditures. And I also cite evidence in the book to back up the claim that more than half of this federal science budget goes to the military. Almost everybody is aware of the absurdity of the size of the military budget, and yet in the realm of the public discourse, very little discussion is devoted to dealing with that problem. And that was a major motive for me for writing this book.
Cliff, do you have a favorite passage from your book, The Tragedy of American Science, that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I found one. Rather than reading something about all the tragedy that we've been talking about, I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs about a counterexample, something positive, so your audience and listeners won't go away from this feeling totally depressed. In the final chapter, I discuss, among other things, pioneering advances in the medical sciences that biotechnology laboratories in Cuba have produced. After I describe some of those advances in detail, I conclude with this, and this, from here on I'm reading the next two paragraphs. The Cuban scientific achievements testify that important, high-level scientific work can be accomplished without being driven by the profit motive. They also show that centralized planning doesn't necessarily have to follow the ultra-bureaucratized model offered by the Soviet Union and China, where big science serves the interest of strengthening the state instead of improving the well-being of the people. Revolutionary Cuba has come closest to realizing the goal of a fully human-oriented science. Although Cuba's small size limits its usefulness as a basis for universal conclusions, its achievements in the biomedical sciences certainly provide hope for the rest of the world. If Cuban science has done so much with so little, what marvels could the mighty engine of American science achieve?
Cliff Connor, you talk about weaponized Keynesianism. What is weaponized Keynesianism?
Well, it's a shorthand way of explaining why the American economy is so extremely dependent on military spending, why the United States devotes an absurd proportion of the national wealth to weapons and war, and why the military budget keeps growing year in and year out. Here's what it boils down to. Without the more than $1 trillion a year in military spending, the American economy would very rapidly collapse into permanent paralysis. In the United States today, if the Pentagon stopped providing a gigantic artificial market for industrial production, millions of workers, and not only workers in weapons plants, would lose their livelihoods. Without paychecks, they wouldn't be able to buy goods or services, and the wheels of the national economy would grind to a halt. And because of that, then the global economy would also collapse. So what's this got to do with science? Military research only accounts for a fraction of the trillions of dollars in war spending. But it's the R&D money spent on creating high-tech weaponry that's at the base of the whole process. It's the science and technology that creates the weapons that the military budget spends trillions of our tax dollars on. That's the short answer to your question. There's more to weaponized Keynesianism than that. But if your listeners want to pursue the issue further, I urge them to read the book.
Yeah, and the book is called The Tragedy of American Science, From Truman to Trump, by Clifford D. Connor. Cliff, talk about what you call the Republican War on Science.
From federal and state legislatures to local school boards, demagogic politicians have spearheaded what some people have called the Republican War on Science, and that goes way back before Trump came on the scene. It's true that the loudest and most obnoxious of the anti-science politicians have been from the Republican side of the aisle. But the political enemies of science include Democrats as well, because the anti-science campaigns, like climate change denial, are funded by bipartisan corporate money. The most obvious example, of course, is the fossil fuel industry, but Big Pharma is a close second. Some people now talk about Trump's war on science, which amounts to a fundamental assault on reason and logic in the interest of corporate profit. And, of course, we're obliged to resist that. But as I said before, the tragedy of American science didn't begin with Trump. He made the problems more obvious and made them worse, but they really began right after World War II, when American policymakers decided to launch the Cold War. And that's why Truman's name is in the subtitle of the book, From Truman to Trump, The Tragedy of American Science, From Truman to Trump. If you want a symbolic icon to represent the beginning of the tragedy of American science, you can think of the mushroom clouds rising over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which were, of course, ordered by Truman. So there's been a political war against science going on in this country for a long, long time, and Trump is just the latest and most absurd manifestation.
Cliff, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you a penultimate question. How would science be different in a socialist society?
Wow, that's a question we could spend hours discussing, but let me try to sum it up as briefly as possible. For one thing, we wouldn't have a huge arsenal of thermonuclear weapons on hair trigger alert threatening to blow us all up. For another thing, we wouldn't be held hostage by the fossil fuels industries who are preventing us from solving the global warming crisis. And we wouldn't have gigantic factory farms churning out pandemics like COVID-19 as their necessary byproducts. But the greatest tragedy of American science, some people have said, and I tend to agree, is in the path not taken. What might have been accomplished if the many trillions of dollars and the enormous amount of scientific talent wasted on military R&D had instead been devoted to finding solutions to the crucial problems facing the world today: poverty, hunger, disease, environmental devastation? Or to put it another way, what could the mighty engine of American science have accomplished if the United States were a socialist country with an economy serving the public interest instead of serving only private corporate interests? What if we had a science for human needs rather than a science for profits? Imagine.
The last question, Cliff, of course, is how do we get there?
Well, that's the funny thing. I mean, I can tell you what we have to do, but doing it is something else, as you know, because we've all been working on this together for a long time. It requires a different kind of political and economic structure than what we have now. I can tell you the first steps. The first steps are to nationalize big pharma, nationalize the fossil fuel industry, nationalize the banks, nationalize the insurance companies, nationalize the military contractors. But for that to happen, and for it to have any meaning, the nationalized economy has to be administered by a government that's democratically controlled by the people of the country, you and me and all the rest of us, rather than the tiny super wealthy elite. And that's what's called socialism.
Cliff Connor, it's been great having you on Law and Disorder. You've just written an excellent book, The Tragedy of American Science, From Truman to Trump. I urge all of our listeners to go out and get the book. Haymarket published it, The Tragedy of American Science. Cliff, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Let me give one more shout out, not only to Haymarket Books, but to Science for the People, a wonderful organization that I urge all of your listeners to look into and to support. Science for the People.
Okay, Cliff Connor, you take it easy, and thanks again.
Thanks, Michael. Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.